Hey, discos. Need a little more Disgraceland in your life? Just a touch to get you through? Yeah, me too. This is the podcast that comes after the podcast. Welcome to Disgraceland, the after party. All right, everybody, welcome to part two of our top 10 countdown of the best Disgraceland episodes. The most disgraceful Disgraceland episodes, possibly. Chosen in part by you listeners by voting on social media. Let's recap part one of the countdown, which came out a couple weeks ago. We had Frank Sinatra at number 10, my favorite episode. Jerry Lee Lewis at number 9. Sid Vicious at number 8. Jay-Z at number 7. Amy Winehouse at number 6. Here we go. Let's get into it. Top 5 Disgraceland episodes of all time. All right, before diving in, just a quick reminder that on January 12th, coming up, the day we launch Season 7, coming up, we are moving all the Disgraceland archives over to Amazon Music. And then beginning February 2nd, new episodes of Disgraceland will be available only on Amazon Music. You will still be able to listen to Disgraceland for free. The easiest way to get yourself set up so that you don't miss a thing is to download the free Amazon Music app right now, or just type www.amazon.com/Disgraceland into your browser. Even easier, if you have an Echo device kicking around, just holler, "Hey Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast." The move to Amazon means that I'll be able to deliver more Disgraceland than ever before. Not only are we dropping 5 new episodes in February, but following that, I'll be in your ears every Tuesday. Not taking any time off. We're just running with it. All right, let's get into it. Kicking off the second half of our countdown of the top 10 best Disgraceland episodes, number 5. The number 5 episode is from the King. Actually, not the King. Prince. Originally released this year in season 5, back in June, on June 9th. This clip we're about to play you is about the one and only Black album, the famous Prince album that was shelved. Here you go. Prince, the purple one. Quite possibly the greatest entertainer of all time. The Black album was funky, sure, a new kind of funk, even a darker funk, blacker than anything on the charts, perhaps even too much funk for the charts. And that scared Prince more than anything. The slip. He picked up the phone and dialed his man at Warner Brothers Records, his record label. Shelve it. What? The album? The album's shipped. It's on trucks, heading to record stores right now as we speak. Turn the trucks around. DJs are already spinning advanced copies. I don't care. Shelve it. Destroy it. I don't want the album coming out. I don't want the world hearing this. It's wrong. And then Prince hung up. And the label had no choice. Prince, despite whatever his contract did or didn't say, was too valuable a commodity to not keep happy. If he didn't want this record to come out, no matter the hassle, no matter the financial loss, upsetting him, alienating him, as big of a star as he was, as big of a cash cow as he was for Warner's, it wasn't worth it to the record label. Best to keep Prince happy. His creative output was legend. Besides, he had, no doubt, another record recorded and ready to ship regardless. The benefits of having an imaginary team of creative alter egos waiting on your every whim to swoop into action. Prince, despite the ecstasy he was on, a big no-no in Prince's world, the use of drugs, was firmly in control. Control of his music, control of his image, control even of his record label bosses. And it had been that way since the beginning. Since the first record contract he signed back in 1977. The contract was legendary because of the creative control it gave Prince, who at the time was a young, largely unknown commodity. 18 years old, in fact, and with complete creative control. An unbelievable concession from the label. Prince would not only be their star recording artist, he'd write his own hits, he'd play all the instruments, he'd produce himself. Total control. Until now. Until the drug caused him to second-guess himself. But prior to the hasty shelving of the Black album, the results had been undeniable. All right, number 5, that was Prince. Love that episode. Loved writing that episode. I remember writing it this year at a time when I definitely needed the distraction at the height of this madness. Wrote that one back in the spring, came out in the early summer. That was number 5, Prince. This is number 4. This is our episode on Big Lurch, the hip-hop cannibal. This was released back in October, right around Halloween season in 2018. And I think this is by far the craziest episode of Disgraceland. I don't know what came over me when I wrote this episode. I just went with it. I think I was in part inspired by the horrorcore vibes of Big Lurch's music and the influence of Eminem. And something came over me, man. Just went for it. This one gets a lot of feedback still to this day, in part because it's just fucking pure madness almost from the jump. And from this clip, you're gonna hear what I'm talking about. Big Lurch had lost his mind. The PCP was in control now. His eyes were like black marbles, vacant. His roommate was 21, stoned herself, and fucking petrified, and rightly so. Lurch was hovering above her, an intimidating figure at almost 7 feet tall. And she didn't know what she'd done wrong or why Lurch was so angry and what in the hell he was ranting about. Blue devils, the world ending, big asses, and who the hell was this Clarice? And what had she done that had him so amped up? Lurch pulled her up to her feet and got down on his knees. He pulled her shirt up, exposing her navel, and pushed his face to a half inch from her stomach skin. He stared into her belly intently and yelled, "I know you're in there, you motherfuck!" The roommate, she was frozen in fear. Her pit bull, chained to the bed, barked madly in the background. Lurch stayed still on his knees and slowly arched his head to his shoulder while continuing to stare into her belly, looking for God knows what. His face screwed itself into a look of bemusement and then frustration. "Come out of there! Come out!" Yeah, I don't know about Big Lurch as it sits in the imaginations of Disgraceland listeners. Obviously, we get a lot of feedback on it, which is why it ended up so high here. But something tells me, like, when I run into folks and I'm talking to them about Disgraceland, no one really mentions this episode to me. I do get messages about it after people hear it for the first time and they're like, "Holy shit, that was fucking crazy," or whatever. I just have this thing in me, like, people skip it because they don't know his name, because he's not a popular artist or something. But hopefully this shines a little light on that episode because it is a doozy. Might be my second favorite of all time. Anyways, here we go. We're going to get into number 3. We're going to get into number 2. And then, of course, we're going to get into number 1 of the greatest, most disgraceful Disgraceland episodes of all time right after this.
We'll be right back after this word.
All right, gonna cheat a little bit here for number 3. Number 3, we got a tie. These are the 2 April Fool's episodes. The Jim Morrison episode that was originally released on April 1st, 2019. I pulled this episode when I woke up in the morning and I saw my phone was almost literally on fire with text messages and social media notifications. This episode was clearly satire. It said it in the beginning that it was satire. Yet a lot of people, at least in my little small corner of the podcast world, believed that it was true and freaked out. And then a lot of people actually got the joke as well, and they freaked out. But all that freaking out freaked me out, and I ended up pulling the episode down because I just got freaking nervous. And I waited, and I put it back up a couple months later. And the joke still worked, despite the fact that it says right at the top that it's satire and it's intended to be satire. And people, there's something about suspended disbelief. People just, they don't want to, they just want to be along for the ride. So, you know, Jim Morrison as a Zodiac killer, sure, I'm in. Love this episode. So much fun to write and to record. And Taylor Bettinson, who helps with research and some of the writing, did an amazing job helping out with this. Anyway, this clip here is where Jim's double life as a Zodiac killer is mapped out via the Doors schedule and really goes kind of hard on trying to sell that, one of the greatest rock stars of all time was also one of the greatest serial killers of all time. Fucking crazy. Jim Morrison. Here we go. Jim Morrison's father, George, had been the military commander at the Gulf of Tonkin, the shady 1964 false flag operation by the U.S. government to justify escalating the Vietnam War. Yes, Jim Morrison's dad basically started the Vietnam War. This is a fact. Look it up. And it was a fact that drove Jim crazy. He literally sold his soul for his art, but even when it came to spilling blood, he was stuck in his father's shadow. His new Zodiac persona could never approach that body count, but he could try. How did he manage this double life? It was easier than you'd think. When you're a notoriously unreliable rock star, nobody questions it when you disappear for a couple days between gigs. One hand washes the other. Let's lay out the timeline. In December 68, the Doors played a local show at the Forum in Inglewood. Afterward, Jim was on his own with no gigs for 2 weeks. That's opportunity. The band had started recording their next album, Soft Parade, and the sessions were not going well. Jim needed a fix. That's motive. 1 week later, the Lake Herman Road murders happened with the killing of Annie Mae Jackson and William Holiday. Then, on July 1st, 1969, the Doors returned to California from a stint in Mexico City for two much-needed days off. The excruciating $500,000, 8-month production of Soft Parade was finally wrapped, and Jim had a break, and he needed it, because he was an insecure wreck. He had no idea if the album was good or not, and feared, like most sensitive artists, that the critics would tear him apart. So Jim needed something soothing again before the upcoming release, and nothing soothed him more or gave him more satisfaction or sense of purpose than killing, than adding to his soul bank. So after the recording of Soft Parade, he was motivated to kill, and with time off, he had the opportunity to go out and quench his bloodthirst, which led to the murder of Diane Maron on July 4th, 1969 in Blue Rock Springs. After this, the Zodiac placed a phone call to the cops, another classic element of the serial killer profile, a desire to get caught. In that recording, when played now, the cadence of the voice, the thinly veiled hidden speech pattern, sounds a lot like the spoken word poetry of one Jim Morrison on his album of poems, An American Prayer. And with that phone call, a line was crossed. The Zodiac, the serial killer inside Jim, was done watching Jim Morrison, the rock star inside Jim, get the credit. The Zodiac was more than that. A poet, a soul shepherd, a killer's killer. And as far as he was concerned, Jim Morrison, the rock star, was a phony, a charlatan. Whatever he was, Jim was lost in a never-ending identity crisis. And it was coming to a boiling point. And this body wasn't big enough for the both of them. All right, Jim Morrison, Jimbo, can also be heard in our series, The 27 Club. We did 12 episodes on Jim Morrison. Search 27 Club to get your Jim fill. You're going to love that. All right, second number three episode. The second episode tied in the third spot is John Denver, another April Fool's episode. This was released this year on April 1st, 2020. I got you fuckers again. I don't know how, but I did. You know, there is a world out there on the internet that believes John Denver killed John F. Kennedy. I swear, I didn't just think of that. It's out there. And I feel like that kind of helped with convincing people that this could actually be true. Again, right out of the gate, says that the show is satire. People fell for it. I love that you fell for it. I love doing these. In this clip, we hear John Denver confessing that he is indeed a secret assassin. Years later, by the time John had become a singing sensation, these days at the Academy were barely even there in his memory anymore. His time there was merely a decade removed, and still, trying to conjure images of this time was next to impossible. Even more difficult to remember were the years following, a black spot in his memory bank. John did his time in the Academy. He remembered nothing of his classmates. Doc, his teacher, was basically all he could recall. Him and the mysterious Mr. Hunt, who visited every couple months or so, observed his training and said little. Hunt, with his big black soulless eyes and giant Dumbo ears, was hard to miss, never mind forget. When John would try to remember those days and come up short, the feeling of frustration would quickly turn to shame, to guilt, and John had no idea why. Perhaps it was due to his time in the war after the Academy. The goddamn Vietnam War. It had torn the country apart. And John was not only ashamed of his personal participation, but also, like most men his age in the 1970s, John was ashamed of his country's participation as well. It seemed so long ago, and like his days at the Academy, John could remember little, less even. He lay back in bed, sipped on his red wine, and tried telling the very sexy, half-naked, career-minded gal at his side what it was like to kill a man. You know, I can't remember hardly anything. I just sit and wait, and wait, and wait some more. And by the time the enemy would cross into my sight, I'd pull the trigger. It was as if all the humanity had already been drained from the situation. I did it so many times that it was all routine. But now the guilt, it's heavy. Heavier than it should be. I mean, we were at war for a reason. They were the enemy. It was kill or be killed, you know? She nodded, shocked, barely able to process what John Denver, one of the country's biggest pop stars, a man known for his peaceful, kind demeanor, was telling her. That he was a secret assassin in the Vietnam War before forging his way in the music industry. All right, there you go. John Denver in at the number 3 slot in the April Fool's episode. I'm going to get down to the nitty-gritty here with number 2. This is the Beach Boys. Beach Boys and Charles Manson. More specifically, Dennis Wilson and Charles Manson. This is originally a 2-part episode that closed out season 4, December of 2019. I love this episode because I'm obsessed with Hollywood in the late 60s and in the early 70s. And that's really what this story is about. Obviously, clear inspiration from Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But this is more about not what happened before, so much before the Manson murders, but what happened after. And I always wanted to get into that sort of paranoid state that some of our biggest stars were in. And we certainly explore that in the second part of the Beach Boys episode. This clip here is Dennis Wilson's burgeoning relationship with Charles Manson, including the notion of getting Manson onto the Beach Boys record label, Brother Records. Charlie Manson was something else, man. Dennis had never seen anything like him, except for maybe Steve McQueen. Charlie was born the son of a gangster and Steve the son of a prostitute. They both had charisma for days and a long string of women, ready and waiting for them whenever they wanted. But unlike Steve, Charlie didn't know shit about cars, other than how to steal them. He didn't really know shit about music either, though he pretended to. He fancied himself a musician anyway. It was part of his whole profit rap that he laid on anyone who would listen, and in the beginning, Dennis Wilson's ears were wide open. So Dennis encouraged Charlie in his music, and Charlie was eager to tap into Dennis's music industry connections. And this was at a time when the Beach Boys had set up their own record label, Brother Records, with a distribution deal with their major label, Capitol Records, in order to promote and sell more cutting-edge and experimental artists. Dennis thought Charlie would be a great fit. His brothers, Brian and Carl, did not share his enthusiasm, and neither did Bruce Johnston or Al Jardine. And of course, for Mike Love, Charles Manson was a hard no. But Charlie wouldn't be dissuaded. He and his girls went on living at Dennis's place, partying, pawning all Dennis's shit off for cash when he wasn't looking. Two of the girls wrecked one of Dennis's cars, which was not insured. It was a parasitic shit show. By the end of the summer, Dennis Wilson had been milked by the freeloaders to the tune of $100,000. Despite all of this, and for reasons nobody really knows, perhaps because of the power and influence of Charles Manson's personality, or because of the sheer amount of LSD Dennis was taking at the time, Dennis tried setting up Charlie with his influential friend and producer of the Byrds, Terry Melcher. Dennis brought Charlie up to Terry's place at 10050 Cielo Drive in the Hollywood Hills, where Terry was living with his movie star girlfriend, Candace Bergen, for an audition. Terry heard Charlie sing and play, and he was not impressed. Like Mike Love, for Terry Melcher, Charles Manson was a definite pass. Manson was pissed, embarrassed. Dennis was positive, as usual. And there would be other producers, other opportunities, he assured Charlie. But Charlie seemed twitchier than usual.
All right, everybody, that was the Beach Boys from Disgraceland. We're going to be back in 2 seconds with the number 1 Disgraceland episode of all time, as voted on by you, the fans. Back at you right after this. All right, let's get into it. Top 5 episodes. Number 5, Prince. Number 4, Big Lurch. Number 3, a tie between the April Fool's episodes and Jim Morrison being the Zodiac Killer and John Denver being JFK's assassin. Of course, those are satirical. And number 2 was the Beach Boys. I kind of combined both parts 1 and part 2 there because in your responses, people didn't really indicate which one. They just said Beach Boys. So, all right, let's get into the number 1 episode of Disgraceland. Rolling Stones episode on Altamont. Now there's been, I think, 5 episodes, 6 Rolling Stones episodes, I can't remember, that I've done so far. Why this one is number one by the listeners, I don't exactly know, but I think maybe it's the spooky fucking weirdness of this episode. This episode means a lot to me. It was not only a great piece of Disgraceland content, but it was originally written as a live show. And I brought it to the stage in Boston, actually in Cambridge at the Sinclair, and in Denver and in San Francisco. And I got to take the show on the road, so to speak, with the Stones at Altamont. And I'll always have a soft spot in my heart for this, just because whenever I think about it, or, you know, if someone mentions it to me, it immediately reminds me of you guys, all the supporters of Disgraceland. A bunch of you guys were met out on the road. And, you know, I'll take that with me forever, and this episode will always remind me of that. I think, you know, another reason this is a popular episode is it gets into more than just the Stones. It gets into the idea of the idealism of the 60s and how that just ran headfirst right into the nihilism of the 70s. That's a really important friction that is endlessly fascinating to digest. It comes up in a bunch of Disgraceland episodes, but none more clearly than in the Rolling Stones Altamont episode. Number one episode of Disgraceland, as voted by you guys. This was originally released in season 4, like I said, December 2019. This clip sets up the concert at Altamont, how things were different, the weird premonitions, shit show that was about to ensue, and of course, the violent death of one of the Stones fans. Number one, Rolling Stones at Altamont.
Mick and Keith began slowly making their way through the grounds in search of whatever the Speedway clubhouse might be. They stepped carefully over sleeping bodies, blankets, shards of metal, and couples who'd had too much weed or wine or acid or all of the above. It was surprisingly cold, and the early festival goers, weary of venturing too far off of the grounds and into the domain of the mountain lions and coyotes, began tearing apart the little available festival fencing there was for firewood. The light from the flames guided Mick and Keith. Murmurs from the weary and stoned fans started burbling up. Soon, a small crowd had filled in behind them as they made their way toward the belly of the speedway. A boy, couldn't have been older than 14, hurried himself from the back and aligned himself to Keith's right. Keith now had a walking stick in his left hand. The boy had a lit joint, a pinner. He said nothing to Keith, just pulled on the grass and passed it to his hero at his left. The two of them, in steady motion, Keith grabbed the joint, puffed, and passed it to Mick to his left. The boy said nothing, just kept walking. Keith did the same. The three of them, the boy included, cool as fuck. The darkness was a mood unto itself. The sinister glow of the campfires, the acid-induced tracers from their sparks, the bitter red jug wine, the smell of grass, and the murmuring makeshift entourage made the moment all the more intense. It was as if all of them, Mick, Keith, the fans, as if they'd all gathered there for the same reason, but deep down felt that something else was going to happen. Mick soldiered on, through the gnawing feeling in his gut. A stoned, sweet little 16 looked up from the blanket she was sitting on as Mick passed, held her arm out in a fey attempt to touch him and said, "Are you real?"
All right, that was the number one episode of Disgraceland as voted on by you guys. Thank you so much. That was the top 5 episodes of Disgraceland. We had Prince at number 5, Big Lurch at 4. Number 3 had Jim Morrison tied with John Denver. And number 2 was the Beach Boys. And of course, number 1, the Rolling Stones at Altamont. Thank you so much for letting us know your thoughts on which episodes you thought were the best. We really appreciate it. Once again, get that Amazon Music app. It's free. That's where you're going to be able to hear the new episodes of Disgraceland. And I guarantee you, you're going to fucking love them. Especially in season 7. Some huge names, Beatles, Oasis, Ramones, and more. It's going to be awesome. Also, lots of new stuff in 2021 that you do not want to miss. Tons of Disgraceland, more 27 Club, more new shows in the works. Stay tuned in early January on everything we got going on. Thank you so much. And here's me reading the phone book from Fresno, California in 1934. L.A., Shirley, Riverside. 78J-32, Silva, Tony, West Riverside, 129J-29, Soderstrom, EM, Robertson West, 106-29. Tharp, Roy, 129J-3, Tully, John, Robertson East, 125-991, Freed and Fuel Company, Robertson Valley, 8656-103, W.W. Warner, Sonoma,
105-706-229.
Quit talking and start mixing.